I'm thrilled to say that this series of Beyond the Bathroom is sponsored by Skin & Me, the subscription skincare service tailored to provide what your skin needs. Make sure to keep listening for a discount code you won't want to miss. That's for later in the episode. Now on with the show. Hi, I'm Sally Hughes and this is Beyond the Bathroom, where each week I chat to my guests about their relationships with their own appearance. In Beyond the Bathroom, I attempt to get under the skin of my guests' beauty routines and rituals and hope to find out exactly what they see when they look in the mirror. How has their past affected the way they see themselves now? When did they look and feel their best? And how has their relationship with face and body shifted as life has ebbed and flowed? Today's guest is a British beauty icon. Patsy Kensit was acting on Hollywood movies before she'd even started school. 13 years on, she was the most photographed British woman outside of the royal family, and 12 years after that, she appeared on the front cover of Vanity Fair with then-husband Liam Gallagher under the line Cool Britannia. A huge moment for British pop culture and the beginning of a media nightmare for Patsy. 54 years, 56 films, 38 different TV shows, 4 husbands and 2 kids down the line, I'm interested to hear from the one at the centre of a life lived behind what was captured on camera. How does a woman whose beauty was admired and celebrated from birth deal with headlines about everything from her weight to her ovaries? How does someone retain a sense of self when her life is seen as media property? Has she learned to love her own reflection? Patsy Kensit, I am beyond thrilled to be beyond the bathroom with you. Welcome. You were, and this is the absolute truth, when we started planning this podcast, you were at the very top of my list for people to talk to.
Is that so?
I really wanted to talk to you. I think your perspective is such a unique one for so many different reasons. And we'll go through all that. But I really want to go back to the beginning, to your family. So I think it's fair to say you're from a very working class,
yes,
London family.
Yes.
Tell me about your mother. Where do you get these genes?
Well, I actually look more like my dad. Mm-hmm. My mum looked like a movie star, and she had she died very young. She had cancer, and I lost her at 20 when I was 22. But she had these violet eyes and dark hair, and she just was just stunning. Great sense of style, but I came from a background, my dad was in and out of prison,
yeah,
my whole life. So and my mother's, her strength and guidance, and also her sense of style was something that you know, it really impressed on me. And I used to sort of sit and watch her doing, putting makeup on, and just thinking, oh my gosh, you're just so beautiful. And I was acting from the age of 4, so we were going from sleeping in one room on 2 mattresses and an outside toilet to going to Pinewood Studios with a chauffeur with a hat on, driven Bentley, to film the Great Gatsby, which is the first movie that I did, mm-hmm. the Robert Redford one, not Baz Luhrmann's.
The Mia Farrow.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And so my mum, you know, we'd be around, I have such vivid memories of the glamour and Ralph Lauren doing my fittings and everything, and then going back to this other world completely. And it was really, gave me a real sense of wonderment and drive. And when my mother became ill when I was very young, and I mean, I'd said goodbye to her probably about 7 or 8 times before the age of 11, and she kept fighting back.
Wow.
Such a positive person. And I just went on this crusade thinking, listen, if I work and I can make money, then I can buy her health, which of course, you know, is a childish kind of crusade to be on. But to the day she died, she was just stunning. And she was before Botox and fillers and all that stuff. She was Irish, so she had beautiful skin. And I made a movie in Russia with Elizabeth Taylor when I was...
I was just going to say, violet eyes, dark hair, sounds like Elizabeth Taylor.
Well, they got on so well. And my mum used to do this thing where she'd put a scarf on her head and she'd sort of pile her hair on top. So it would have a really nice sort of little, the back, we kind of back combed, and it was a lovely
a
shape.
Kind of bumpy thing.
Yeah, and it was a great shape on her head. And Elizabeth came down to my mum and said, listen, you know, I love this look. And you would, and
oh,
you
know, so I know, I'd have died.
Well, my mum was just, you know, she was, I mean, obviously flawed completely, but she was, she had such amazing style. And she worked at Christian Dior in the press office.
Right.
And then met my rogue father, who, you know, my dad, and he was a flawed guy, but I, you know, it was my dad, and I loved him. But she met my father, he had a nightclub, and they met there. But she dated the Aga Khan.
So was this in the 60s?
This is in the 60s.
I mean, this is such a 1960s story, isn't
it?
He had a nightclub in and out of prison. She looked like Elizabeth Taylor. Yeah. I mean, it's just so 1960s.
So 1960s. Mm. And really glamorous, but yet going back to having nothing. And then we moved over the road to the council estate and had a little house. And that was, you know, and I just, every year of my life since the age of four, I've worked. I mean,
I'm so interested in this for so many reasons. I don't even know where to start. As a little girl, and you're, apart from the fact that you have this like devastatingly glamorous mother, you're working with somebody who still to this day is easily one of the all-time great beauty icons in Elizabeth Taylor. Yeah. I mean, she's my beauty icon. I just think she was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life. What did you think as a little girl? That must have been so peculiar to see this sort of vision.
I sucked it all up. I mean, she was so wonderful and so funny and so kind. And she was, you know, very nurturing, and she had the big ring. She just got divorced from Richard Burton, and she was
first time or second?
First,
okay.
And she was with a guy called Henry something. He was a photographer, and basically, we in Russia at that point, it was communist Russia, so we had to book phone calls out, and Elizabeth would come down to our suite and say, "Listen, I'm going to buy a suite to Richard. Can I book the call from here?" And she'd come down, and my mum would take me out of the sort of the bedroom area, and she'd be in there talking. So for her, for my mum to be seeing all that, because that was equivalent to, say, Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, if you've got to make a comparison. But there really isn't one.
No,
there really isn't. But that was, I just loved her. And she had the big diamond ring, which she would say, she'd play catch with it. She'd take it off and she'd go, "Patsy, catch."
Wow.
And I, you know, throw it back. Or she'd say, "Well, why don't you wear it?" And my mum would be like, "Oh my God, what if she loses that ring?" And it was just, it was wonderful. She was such a professional. And like I said, best sense of humour, really down to earth, a girl's girl. And like I said, really nurturing.
Oh my! I mean, I want to now do a 12-part podcast series where I just grill you about Elizabeth Taylor. The other thing I find so interesting about your perspective is that you are among the only people I've ever talked to who has been in show business effectively her whole life.
Yeah, 50 years.
And so you were four. And what, you're 54 now?
I'm 54 now, yes.
So your whole life,
yeah,
you've been in the public eye. There is stuff that goes with that. And I'm sure you won't argue with me when I say that you were an objectively very, 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 very pretty little girl.
Mm.
And that would have been important to what you were doing, certainly then.
Yeah.
You know, you were such a gorgeous child. And you must have been told that when you were very little. Were you told that prior to entering the business, or?
No, and, you know, not so much, because my mum was a very modest person and would, you know, would not kind of, and I don't think she realised how amazing she was and breathtaking. And I, you know, I would be going back to, you know, I pay for my own education, and so I would go off and film and then have to go back to the convent and, you know, get the bus to school. And I had to walk past a comprehensive school, and they used to throw rocks at me and stuff because we had to wear our uniforms.
Sure.
If we didn't have our hat on or whatever.
Sure.
Somehow the nuns found out and you get detention.
Yeah.
And so I was tough. I would say I was very tough. I think that I wasn't aware about, I always loved clothes, and then all the other stuff just, I just went with it. But I was in no way delusional and thinking I was anything special. I just thought that I knew that I was and seen upon someone as a person who, you know, was a certain age and could deliver. I was very professional, and that was something that my mum really instilled in me, and my work ethic, which I passed on to my sons.
Your mother wasn't somebody prone to constantly talking about how you looked. Yeah. I always think that's interesting when I hear mums do that. I think all dads do that. I think it's a bit of a weird thing to do to a child, isn't it?
It is. Then I think because of obviously, you know, as I grew up, you know, you change and you go through the kind of weird sort of phase where your nose doesn't really fit your face. Everything's kind of coming together. And I was, you know, I was very comfortable in my skin. I think that, though, not from my mum, but I think from the industry, there was always been a lot of pressure about body size. And that's something that...
Even when you were little?
From about the age of sort of 13.
Wow.
Because it was, you know, I was in puberty and things, you know, everything does change. And I felt, I never felt it from my parents, but I could sense that there was that kind of, it's almost a judgment on body type, which thank God now we are. And, you
so
know,
what would that look like? You'd be on castings? Auditions?
It would be more about doing the job and, you know, being fitted, and then maybe having to be, you know, the costume having to be sort of altered because, you know, you're developing, you know, breasts, or you've got a bit of puppy fat.
Sure.
And which is all normal. And it could, I think that's the only thing. I mean, I've got boys, so, same. But the word fat was never spoken in my house and growing up, and it's something that, you know, I even, you know, people think it's more prevalent to girls and women, but it isn't. I mean, boys are just as susceptible,
more so than before, for sure.
That'd be exactly. So I was very, very cautious and careful about, you know, the language that was used, and, you know, they're both just great guys.
I suppose the kind of archetype for child star would be, say, Judy Garland.
Yes.
So we know that Judy Garland really struggled with the idea that she had to remain a girl. She had to remain a girl and was put on diet pills and all of that stuff that sounds so shocking when we learn about it now. Did you have a sense that you needed to remain cute and sweet and little?
I think that there, at a point, I was just getting too old for the roles that I was sort of, you know, nailing before. I was, like I said, 13, 14. But I was very lucky and managed to work at the BBC for years and did all the classics with them. And I kind of, because my mother was very private because of my dad's activities, and in those days, had it all come out, and my career would have been over. So
what was, for anybody listening who's not familiar, what was the nature of your father's criminality?
It's called long-term fraud. It was organised crime. Mm-hmm. And he worked with the Crays. Reggie Cray was my brother's godfather. And also with the Richardsons, which is very odd because they were two, you know,
rivals.
But my dad was he had the gift of the gab, and it was, you know, he in his prime, he was fabulous. So he became sort of institutionalized after being in and out of prison for so many years. It was really sad when he was, you know, he got leukemia and he died when I was 17. So, but because of my mum being private and keeping, she would never let me do interviews. So whenever there was requests for press as I was growing up, she always refused. And that not only was, you know, saved, I think, her a huge embarrassment, it also enabled me to become an adult actress. It's very hard to make the transition.
Yes, that's true.
And because people didn't know about what I ate for breakfast and, you know, where we lived or any of that, they were able to accept me as, you know, becoming an ingenue, and then, then becoming an adult actress. And that was really clever and savvy on my mum's part. I'm very grateful because when I bit the beast of doing media and sort of the fame thing, which came around Absolute Beginners.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd always been regarded as this very serious, just very successful actress, and then suddenly I'm in a film and none of that counted anymore. It was all, you know, thrown out the window, and it was like I'd worked all these years and suddenly I'm, you know, the success of this film, and I was a baby when I did it, was
I
on
remember
my shoulders.
That period so well, so well. I remember it like it was yesterday because I was a huge David Bowie fan.
Oh, gotcha.
That song was so beautiful. The song came out first.
Yes.
And it was so beautiful. Also, I was a devoted Just 17 reader. And
oh, yes.
You were in Just 17 every single week. Every single week. In the run-up to the film.
Yeah.
And after the film. And I have such vivid memories of that period. I definitely think it's fair to say that you were the most famous woman in pop culture in the UK at that time. And it went on and on and on. And as you rightly say, you're not exaggerating. That entire film became about you and how, whether your performance measured up, how you looked in every scene, what you did at parties that you went to or who you went out with. And what were you, 17 or something?
By that point, 17.
I mean, that's extraordinary. You were everywhere. I remember it so vividly.
It was a hard time. It was very difficult because...
So I would have been 10 or 11, I think.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So I think having sort of prided myself on being under the radar and doing all this great work and then to do this film. And now, of course, people, they love the movie now.
Yeah. I mean, it's had a total
hindsight,
kind of revisionist thing, hasn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. For me, just the chance to work with David Bowie, I don't care. I'd just filmed The Phone Book with him. I mean, just to be in the same room.
Yeah.
And he was so wonderful. But it was very much a backlash for me. And at the same time, I joined my brother's band, which was like, it's ridiculous because I can't sing for Toffee. But I was doing that. And so I was offered a lot of roles after Absolute Beginners, despite the negativity. But I wanted to focus on the music like a fool. So I did that. And then, of course, I ended up working with the Pet Shop Boys and we had this massive success.
I mean,
this,
I'm Not Scared's a great record.
Really,
it really is still a great record.
They were geniuses. They are geniuses.
Yeah. So you're focusing on the music. You're not picking up the acting opportunities being afforded to you.
Yes.
Why did you make that decision? What was it about acting that appealed less at that time? Had you just been burnt too much by the...
I think that I was so in love with music and with that time. I mean, I was going to the Wag Club at 14 and it was like walking into a room full of the top 20, the top of the pops, you know, Sade, Heck 100, Spandau Ballet. I mean, it was just, so I was, you know, going to these clubs very young. I'd go, actually, my brother would my mum would let me go because Jamie and I would go together. So I got very immersed in that and we had this big record deal and then it didn't kind of work as like we thought it would. And then I ended up doing this song with Neil and Chris, the Pet Shop Boys. And at that point, I would say that I loved doing that and I'm very proud of that song, but I was only continuing with it because I felt guilty for my brother because I forced him to let me worm my way in. And I felt that I knew that I couldn't improve as a singer, but I did know that I had so much that I can learn and that I could grow as an actor. That's just a place and a space that I've been in my entire life. And I believe that, you know, I could learn more. And I kind of, there was an end of the road for music. So we had that huge success and traveled the world and everything. And I just said to the guys, look, I'm I can't do this anymore. I'm so sorry. And the following week, I got offered Lethal Weapon 2 and sort of just got thrown. I was 19, thrown straight back into the industry and, into one of the highest grossing movies, of that of that time.
What is it about inhabiting somebody else's skin, being somebody else for a bit, that is appealing as a job?
Well, you can live vicariously through characters, because if you get to play somebody who's like totally like a real bitch, mean, and say all the things that I never would, that's fun. It's changing your appearance, I think, is a great, that to me appeals to me. I think the thing about acting is, the love of it for me is that you move on, you play a character and you film for 3-5 months and then you go on to the next thing. I went into Emmerdale at a time, and it was just sheer luck, the stars aligned. I went into that show, and at the same time it started to beat all the ratings against EastEnders. So I thought I'd only be going in for 3 months, and I ended up playing the character Sadie King for 2.5 years. And I loved it. It was great. It was wonderful. But playing the same role,
Yes, that's different,
isn't it? It's very different. And then I went straight from that to Holby City, and I was 4.5 years on that show. And so, and loved it. And the writers were great. They wrote brilliant for me on both of those shows. But I was really excited about going back to just, doing a job and not necessarily having the security of continuing drama. So I've been lucky. I worked through COVID. I've just finished a movie called Miss the Kiss. It's a fantastic script, great role. And I just, I'm just seeing where life takes me and what gets sent to me and what's,
It's hard for actresses. I think what is easier for very good-looking actresses when they're younger is harder for very good-looking actresses when they're older, right? I was recording another in this series with the comedy actress Diane Morgan, brilliantly talented actress, and she was saying, she was saying something along the lines of, it's harder if you're very pretty, because if you're a comedy actress or a character actress, you're allowed to look bad, you're allowed to look dodgy, or you're allowed to age, you're given permission to age. Do you feel, with someone like you who has always been so good looking, objectively, if you went to someone in the street, they would say, Patsy Kensett's really good looking. Do you feel there's more of a pressure to hang on to it?
I think what happened to me in the 90s, I embarked on a very high profile marriage.
Yeah.
With my youngest
son. Well, a couple of high profile marriages.
Absolutely, exactly. And I became, again, it was like going back to the absolute beginner's days, but it was full on. I mean, people outside my house, photographers 24/7, and being ripped apart for being too thin, too fat, too this, too that. And what it left me with, and this is something that I've had to work on, is a sense of agoraphobia, because
that's so interesting.
It's the honest truth, and so now it's great, because no one gives a toss anymore. I can walk down up and down West End Lane and with greasy hair and sweatpants, and no one gives a toss. But for years I was so bullied. And I remember going to do the food shop at in one of the supermarkets, and at the cash, the till, when you're paying, they have all the magazines at one side, all those weekly magazines, and they'd be like Fatsy Patsy, and
that's
picture
nice
of me with terrible cellulite. I have cellulite from my earlobes down. I'm covered.
So do
in,
I.
I mean, I'm covered in it.
So do I.
So it was things like, Patsy scoffs it, and it would be me eating a cake walking down the road. I can look back now and laugh, but it gave me a sense of just not wanting to leave the house.
It's absolutely vile. So for our younger listeners,
yes.
So Patsy was married to Liam Gallagher. At that time, I cannot express what a huge deal it was, because you were the sort of involuntary female figurehead of a movement. So Cool Britannia, as it was known, was happening. Tony Blair was coming into power. With very much the help of that pop culture movement, you were on the cover of Vanity Fair.
Yes.
With your husband, wrapped in a Union flag.
Yeah.
And so through that cover and through your marriage, you became the kind of girl of that movement. There was you, there was Sadie Frost, there was Meg Matthews, there were, you know, Kate Moss, those girls. And you were on the cover. And so people were, I think, looking at you because it was such a huge movement, but also looking at you for reasons to bring down the movement because you had been part of seeing in a new government, a change and so on. So what did that look like? People outside your house, people calling you fat, people trying to get ugly pictures of you, and anybody can have ugly pictures taken off them. It's not possible to be pretty in all pictures. And so what? You're opening, what, Heat, The Sun, The Mirror, and your Fatsy Kensit or your whatever you are that week.
Yes.
And so, I mean, that's bloody horrible.
Like heartbreaking.
And you have children.
Well, I mean, I was always very, very protective about the boys being photographed. And they went through a phase because we'd always get invited to premieres of the new Disney film coming out. Sure. Isn't that? And, you know, I had to sort of put them in the bin immediately so the kids didn't see them because they wanted to go. And I said, look, you know, I'm not making that decision for you when you're 16, 17. You know, we'll have the conversation, but I'm not putting you in a situation that could be very painful and mean. And so, and now they thank me. I mean, they're doing, you know, they're both super, super, super successful. I'm so proud of them both. And they're just good guys. And they're not the, I think that to be the sons of the fathers that they have, you know, it can't have been easy. But I myself don't sort of have a relationship with the dads. I mean, obviously, what the boys, you know,
support that relationship.
But it's always for me, it has been really important to have that male energy in their lives because I didn't have it with my dad. And I always chose men that went away a lot, going on tour, and my dad was going away to prison all the time. So I felt like I was really, and to their credit, they were super, super, you know, loving and wonderful to the boys. They had their relationship with their dads, and I, you know, as far as I'm concerned.
I'm not personally an Oasis fan. I don't really have much of an opinion, negative or positively, on the Gallaghers. However, I did see a documentary about Liam last Christmas, I think. And there was one thing in it that really, really struck me that I was talking to my girlfriends about afterward. The kids are in it, various kids with various women. the kids are in it and he's interacting with his children in a really sweet, nice way or whatever. And he says to camera afterwards, he says, one thing I'm really, really grateful for that I can't take credit for is that all the women I had children with are really, really, really good mothers.
He said that?
Yeah.
He
said...
That's a shock.
He said I chose really, really good mothers and I can't take credit for what they did, but they were all really amazing mothers. And I noticed it because it was quite an unusual moment from him. Like, it was quite a sort of tender, I suppose, and vulnerable moment of saying, this wasn't to do with me, it was about them, and I accidentally chose really, really, really amazing mothers who brought up the kids well. So it's funny, you protected them from all that, not taking them to the premiere or whatever, not taking them to the stuff. Probably got that from your mum, who'd done the same for you in a way. But what about you in all of this? You weren't protecting yourself because there was no protecting you. You were an adult. And so how did that leave you and your self-esteem about how you looked, with people constantly describing how you looked?
I think that for so many years, my best girlfriend of 24 years, because I stopped buying the papers, Elton John, actually, we were in Milan at a Versace show, and there was a dinner afterwards, and Elton came and sat down, and it, you know, we were really being like, it was a witch hunt at that point. And he just went, you know, how are you? And I just said, you know, it's just awful every day, you know, you open the paper. And he said to me, why would you do that? Why would you read that? He said, I don't read anything. You have a good lawyer, you know, if something's litigious, then they'll contact you, and then you proceed as you see fit. And it was the best advice I ever got. And so I stopped. I watched the news on TV, and I just thank God that social media wasn't rife at that time.
Yeah.
Because I think it would
trolling.
Be very, 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 very dark. I sound like I'm whinging. Listen, I've had a great life. It's, there've been some great highs, some real lows, but it's been a huge adventure and I don't regret anything. If I actually, I lie. If I do regret anything is that I used to care too much about what people thought.
So that's interesting to me. So you mentioned that it got so bad that it got to a point where you were fearful of leaving the house, fearful of going out. So you must have cared terribly. Before we talk about how you feel now, in that moment, what were you frightened of?
Just it being followed and not being able to just like walk out your front door and have seven or eight photographers there and fans also, and people just ringing the bell, you know, wanting to see, you know, who was home and could they get an autographs. And I mean, it was very with my eldest son's dad. He was very private. He is very private.
Yeah.
So that it was kind of more
so this is Jim
under
Kerr
control.
From Simple Minds. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so
I always allude to them as their dads. So I'm hilarious too. But that was a very kind of, I felt that was a very secure situation. I mean, you know, they were hugely successful, you know, one of the best bands
but
I've ever
seen
live.
But a very different vibe.
Very different vibe. And then to go into, I remember my manager at the time said to me, you know what, you've never been in the bizarre column in the Sun. And he said, and now literally overnight, you're in it every day. Mm. And that was true. My confidence went, I think I made poor choices. I look back and think, you know, I shouldn't have let things get to me, but it did. And I was scared and I was young, you know, I was 25, 26. And then, you know, had my son when I was 28, 29. What I think pulled me through and got me, you know, I always worked. I worked through all of those marriages. I didn't sit back and, you know, get manicures and pedicures and treatments every day. I was constantly filming. But I knew that I had to be present for my boys because there were days when I did not want to come out from under the duvet. People can't wait to tell you, even if you're not reading it, something awful that's been written. And so I would start, first of all, a conversation with my best friend going on a weekend on a Sunday. Oh God, is there anything in the papers? And she would say, no, don't worry. And then she might say, oh, yes, it was a nice picture of you.
Worst. It happens to me all the time.
Well, exactly. And then my next question was, do I look fat? Do I look fat? And it was just insanity. Mm. But what my strength that I had my kids and I had to, if they'd seen me fall apart, what kind of mother am I to them to show them that to give up or, you know, not get up and have a shower and get through the day. And some days it was very hard.
Yeah.
And there were also days when I was filming and I'd have to go to work and I knew everyone knew what was going on and all these horrible things, stories and people, you know, things happening within relationships that didn't involve me, other women and everything. And it was just very hard to have to go and walk on a film set.
Horrible.
And think everyone in here knows.
Horrible.
And what are they thinking? And
humiliating.
Yeah, it's humiliating, which is what, you know, the reason that...
That's the worst, isn't
yes.
it? When you're a kind of, you're a proud and professional person.
Yes.
Who's always turned up, done her job, done her thing.
Absolutely.
And gone, that's horrible to have that kind of invasion into your privacy. What is it about getting older that has made you care less about that stuff?
Well, I mean, I think turning, as I said, I'm 54 now, but in your 40s, you just, you know, you do what you can to, I just want to look the best I can for the age that I'm at. I don't want to look, I mean, it's not possible anyway, but I'm not sort of seeking the elixir of youth. I think that I think men to me become way more interesting when they're in their 50s. which is, you know, a revelation to me. And
I mean, I think that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I work out, I run,
What do you do? What kind of working out?
I do a 7K. It's a run stroke walk and it's all uphill. I live in North London and I go up to Hampstead Heath. So I'll do that. I'll go and get facials. I think that's important and very, and I try to never go to bed with my makeup on, but I can't say I haven't.
Sure.
And then just to, drink lots of water. I don't drink tea or coffee. I like to have a drink, but I don't, that's very rarely now. Do I do that? And trying to eat well and just accepting, that I'm a middle-aged woman. Mm. Beyond that, I mean, I'm into the last quarters coming up,
I wonder if losing your mum when she was young
has
affected how you feel about getting the opportunity to get older, I suppose.
Well, I think...
How old was she when she died?
She was 52.
Okay, so you're already older than she was.
That. And the thought of my kids... losing me, and at the age they are, and obviously they're much older than I was when my mother died. I mean, it would be devastating.
Yes.
I mean, they are we are so tight, the three of us, and they're such a blessing. I mean, I've got it's my biggest achievement is having those boys, and just they were a nightmare when they were teenagers. I mean, it's just, but then they come back because I've got friends who've got a teenager and they're going, what's happened? I don't know what's happened. I said, don't worry. They come back and then they're really nice. And you're quite sort of suspicious. Why are you being, you've hated me for like 4 years and all of a sudden I'm, you're putting your arm around me, walking down the street and everything. The thought of me, not being around is traumatizing. But I'm not afraid of death. I'm afraid of being sick.
Yes.
Because I watched that.
Yes.
Work with my dad and my mum.
Yes.
But I'm not afraid of dying. I got into meditation about 6-7 years ago. I saw the George Harrison documentary and I thought, I'm going to try that. And actually, I ended up going to a retreat in Thailand and that changed my life.
Skin and Me, our brilliant sponsor here on Beyond the Bathroom, is a subscription skincare service tailored to provide exactly what your skin needs. I can vouch personally for both the service and the treatment because I myself have been a paying Skin and Me subscriber for almost 2 years and I wouldn't be without it. It's a personalised service that's tailored for your skin. Skin and Me treats conditions like acne, rosacea and hyperpigmentation, plus it works on more general skin goals like my own. Greater glow, smoother texture, softer fine lines and wrinkles and more. Each month you'll receive a personalised dermatologist-designed solution packed with powerful, scientifically proven active ingredients you can't buy over the counter. Delivered in a recyclable dispenser called the Daily Doser that you twist and click each night to deliver just the right amount of cream required for a nightly application, making sure that you get the correct dose that won't damage your skin barrier. Because Skin and Me are so confident that you'll love it as much as I do, they're offering all Beyond the Bathroom listeners the opportunity to trial their first month of Skin and Me for just £3.50 instead of at the regular cost of £24.99. That includes all the check-ins you want or need, plus reformulations and advice on tap. Skin and Me want happy, healthy skin for everyone. No dermatologist wait lists required. Just use the code SALIHUGHES, SALIHUGHES, at checkout at skinandme.com to redeem the offer. That's SALIHUGHES at skinandme.com.
Is meditation your moment? I always ask my guests, what's their Skin and Me moment? Like, what's the moment where they're just so content and happy in their skin? Is meditation that for you?
Yeah, I do guided meditation. I've got to the level now. I mean, I see colours. I feel like my kind of, it's going to sound so hokey, but it's like my soul kind of does like somersaults inside me. It's so beautiful. I make sure that I do that every day. If I don't, I don't feel so centred. And it really has been a blessing.
Talk to me about menopause, because it's been such a joy to see so many women of profile and women who have no profile, who are just out there living their lives, talking about menopause for, without question, the first time in this honest, kind of frank and full and generous way.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about your experiences of that and how you felt along the way?
Well, I mean, I wasn't even perimenopausal, but in my sort of, about 44, I was kept getting these complex tumours in my in my womb, and they removed. I had one very big one. It was removed. It was benign. But then within 6 months, two more had grown back, huge ones. One was attached to my bowel, and the other one was...
Must have been so frightened.
Well, it was... When I got a call, I went to see the ultrasound person, and you know, I was looking at his face, thinking, what's he saying? And I went home, and then when my gynecologist called me at 11 o'clock at night and said, you have to come into hospital tomorrow and have a hysterectomy.
Wow.
So... I was rushed into hospital.
So you were catapulted into menopause.
Totally. Woke up with the, in intensive care. And there was a 30-year-old girl who had the same thing, and she had cancer.
Wow.
And hadn't had children yet either. And
so you're 44 at this point.
I'm 44. And so I wasn't prepared mentally at all for the change, what would happen. And it's perfectly named the change. It's conscious puberty. Because you go
that's
through it.
That's a good way of putting it.
But it is. And as you were saying, nobody really discussed it. And I didn't have any friends that were going through it.
No, you must have been thinking it was, what, 5-6 years away at least.
Exactly. But I lost my mind. I thought I've got dementia.
Wow.
I didn't drive. I've driven my whole life. And I wouldn't drive anymore. I didn't trust my concentration, brain fog, having a conversation like we are now, and me after two words saying, actually, what were we talking about again?
Yeah.
Complete.
Yeah.
And so people looked at you like...
And that was immediate, was it?
That happened immediately. And I was put on HRT, and it was sort of a blanket.
Yes.
Covers all.
Old-fashioned HRT.
Exactly. And it just wasn't working for me. And I went and saw this doctor, Amalia, her name is.
She's my doctor.
Are you in the bio?
At the London Hormone Clinic.
You're probably not at that point.
But I was going mental about something else, and she fixed it, and I'm not going anywhere. I'm never leaving her.
She's amazing.
I'll put her details in the programme notes. Her name's Dr. Amalia at the London Hormone Clinic.
She's amazing.
She's my doctor.
She said, she said it's changed my life because I do the bio identicals.
Yeah.
So I give blood every 6 months, and then, she reads what you have, what you don't have. And it's... For me, I mean, I'm fortunate that obviously it's, you have to pay for that kind of help. I just think it's so unfair.
It's a massive privilege.
Yes.
So I have the same doctor as you, which we had no idea
about
prior to this conversation. She's amazing. And I went to see her having been stonewalled by my GP for a couple of years. I just thought I was going mad. I was just so sorrowful. And I went to see her, and she fixed things and made things better so immediately that it just made me angry. Of all the women around the country who will not get that help.
No, this is it.
Because it's such a position of extreme privilege. And when I went to see her, I think the first time I went to see her, I spent about £1,000. You know, it's like a lot of money that most people just aren't able to access.
Yes.
And you think of all the women around the country who must feel so confused, so sorrowful, so anxiety ridden, going into work, driving their cars, as you say, living their lives and thinking, what the fuck is going on?
What's going on? And like it's a stigma.
Yeah.
And in some, some ways that you're less of a woman now because you're...
Did you feel that?
I mean, I was never going to have any more kids.
Yeah.
But it's just, obviously, I was in my 40s, so for me, it wouldn't have been something that I'd want to do. But having had it, that decision removed completely was something that I did think about and think, but it was, I thank God I didn't have ovarian cancer, which they thought I did. and I found the right doctor. I have these lozenges that are bespoke.
Yeah.
And again, it's an expensive process. Yeah. And I think that with HRT, in my humble opinion, one size does not fit all.
Yeah.
We all have varying levels of, I mean, I had no estrogen, no progesterone. I mean, if you can't lose weight if you're not producing progesterone.
Yes.
Progesterone and all of that stuff. And so I was getting sort of a bit bloated. The minute I started the lozenges, everything, you know, kind of went back to normal. Vitamin D, so important.
Oh, yeah, mine was off the charts low.
Yeah,
it's terrible.
It's terrible. So important. Mm. And I take a big dose of that once a month. And I would highly recommend any woman to go and, you know, and get some, because it's like, I mean, it affects everything, your mood.
It does. It affects literally everything.
Yeah. So so I'm at a place now where I'm kind of cruising nicely. It's very stable, to use a old-fashioned word, but life feels very stable.
Do you feel pressure as an actress to have injectables? Or actually, do you feel no pressure, but you just like them? I love getting Botox. I don't feel under any pressure. I just like it.
I mean, listen, I get Botox.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's something that I think everything else, when the time comes, you know, I wouldn't be opposed to, you know, having a little something, you know, your jaw or whatever. Mm. I think there is, again, a stigma can be addressed with this area, with cosmetic procedures. But I think that it's become so good now. And I think the horror stories, and you see people that have overdone it and everything. I'm too afraid to have fillers, because it's not a look that I would like.
Yeah.
But for Botox, I just think, you know, yeah, it's great. Every 6 months, I'll go to Dr. Johnny D'Souza. He's amazing.
Okay, so we don't go to the same Botox doctor. We don't. So finally, the coincidence is stopped.
Exactly. We vibe though today. It's amazing. Joan Collins was on TV the other morning, and I mean, she's just fabulous. You
she
know,
looks so great,
isn't she? She's just.
I've
so
interviewed
great.
Joan Collins, and I interviewed her in her apartment. And there's just something around her. There's an aura around her that's just so sparkly.
Yeah.
And she's, and you, I mean, obviously you've, I'm sure, met her lots of times, but she's girlish.
Yes. No.
There's something girlish about her.
There's a youthful
She's
energy.
She's naughty.
Yeah. And, you know. And she's, you know, they don't make them like that anymore.
No.
Really.
No.
This is one of, you know, she's such a treasure.
Yeah.
She really is.
How do you feel now when you look in the mirror? Do you like who you see and what you see?
Well, because I've got into all of the, you know, meditation and you know, having to tell yourself in the mirror, you know that you love yourself and that you're healthy and strong. I mean, all that stuff growing up, that was, I mean, I'd have got a clip around the ear if I was going, I love myself. And it was very much... that you didn't use language like that.
No, absolutely.
So I kind of find it a little bit awkward, but I've sort of following these suggestions and steps and everything, and it does have an impact and make a difference.
Are you somebody who's quite happy in a tracksuit and no makeup and a ponytail?
I go home and immediately put on my PJs.
Yes,
flannelette pajamas from Primark, and my luxury is cashmere socks, and that's it. Wash my face, sit with the cat, my best friend. I mean, I just worship him. He's just the best company. And I'm very happy, very content. I have a quiet life now. I've got a small group of really great friends that I've had for many years. And there's been a lot of tragedy this year. One of my best girlfriends, Grania Fletcher, who's married to Andy Fletcher from Depeche Mode, her husband, dropped down dead. And we were all there in the house when it happened. So I've watched her in awe at the strength. And I mean, they've been together 30 plus years. And to see that beauty and grace in her and how she dealt with it all, I'm going to get upset talking about it, actually. I think when I look at my girlfriends as well, I'm very lucky, because I can say something to them and it doesn't go any further. That wasn't the case in my life years ago. And I think that that's something that I've weeded out, and I know that you know, I can be confide, and it stops there, and that's beautiful.
I'm exactly the same.
Yeah,
I'm exactly the same. My girlfriends are the most important thing in my life, because everything is absolutely locked down.
Yeah.
And
we're all a bit nuts. I mean, I've got to, you know,
of course,
actresses as a group, we tend to be quite, you know. So, but you want to be able to vent and say possibly mad things, and for you not to be judged about it.
Well, I don't think you're a bit mad, Patty Kensit. I think you're lovely, and I'm so grateful to you for being so honest and vulnerable and real with me today. I know it'll mean a lot to lots of women who've been through similar things. And actually, you know, you don't have to have been famous your whole life to have gone through these things. They're real things that all women go through.
That's right.
That sort of grief and divorce and menopause and ill health and child rearing and all of that stuff is something that we can all relate to. So thank you so much for sharing it with me.
Thank you. And I'm a huge fan of yours. I think what you do is brilliant. And women are great.
Oh, well, I'm thrilled that we got together. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please subscribe and follow to Beyond the Bathroom wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoyed the show, we'd love it if you left a rating and a review. I'll see you next time with my next guest. Bye. Insanity Group.